You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being written by underwritten by Teamsters Joint Council 56 and United Auto Workers Local 249. Teamsters Joint Council 56 and our nine local unions represent 30,000 workers, retirees, and their families in Western Missouri, Kansas, and Nebraska. We are proud to support the Heartland Labor Forum and their commitment to give working families a voice in the greater Kansas City community. United Auto Workers Local 249 members building the best Ford trucks and vans in the world. And the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. Tonight on the Heartland Labor Forum, planning a road trip? Do you want to learn if your travels may take you near some of labor's sacred places? This week, we talked to Saul Schneiderman, who has assembled a guide to America's labor landmarks. Then, Trump is proposing massive changes to rules for asylum, which would make it impossible, almost impossible, for desperate people fleeing persecution to gain entry into the U.S. We'll talk to local immigration attorney Claire Murphy Shaw about the possible impact. In the news, UMKC faculty send demands to the chancellor, and is the mishandling of the pandemic by Trump and the Senate leading to new waves of organizing and strikes? And we don't have a feature at the end of the show tonight because we have two super long and involved segments, so stay tuned for that. And now for the news. And this is the news from our side, July 30th, 2020. Is the mishandling of the pandemic by Trump and the Senate leading to a new wave of organizing and strikes? Former New York Times labor reporter Stephen Greenhouse, writing for the LA Times, says yes. In recent decades, we have rarely seen so much worker anger and so many strikes as we've seen since COVID-19 hit America. Fears of the virus have greatly emboldened American workers. He goes on to say, the pandemic has thrown into stark relief the desperation of many essential workers and the callousness of powerful employers toward their safety and welfare. We may look back on this calamitous year as a pivotal moment when unions regained support as being critically important to building a fair economy and society. Greenhouse cites McDonald's workers in LA, San Jose, and Oakland who have protested lack of PPE, farm workers in Washington State demanding safety and hazard pay, Amazon workers who struck in New York, Chicago, and Minnesota over PPE, Instacart workers in many cities who struck over hazard pay, masks, and sanitizer. And then there were thousands of Black Lives Matter strikers last week. On Tuesday, the American Federation of Teachers threatened massive teacher strikes if schools reopen without safety measures. This is starting to look like a movement, the likes of which we haven't seen since the Great Depression. Greenhouse mentions the rising support for unions with 64% of Americans now approving of them, and an MIT study found that half of unorganized employees would vote to join a union if they could. Support for unions is especially high among young workers whose futures have been wrecked first by the 2008 recession and now COVID-19. But of course, fear is a huge impediment because employers overwhelmingly oppose unionization of their workers. They hire union busters, and they often fire workers who try to unionize. But despite this, last week, tens of thousands of child care providers in California voted for a union. Workers at the Kansas ACLU just unanimously voted for the United Media Guild to represent them, despite blatant attempts to unionize by their employer. And workers at the Truman Hospital are awaiting the results of their union election to join the SEIU. Their results will be announced next week.
On Friday, the newly revived chapter of the American Association of the University Professors at UMKC sent a 14-page letter to the chancellor outlining their opposition to his plan to restructure the university. The plan is called UMKC Forward. It begins by saying, periods of intense crisis like the one we are currently living in call for collective decision-making processes and the strengthening of individual support systems. UMKC Forward does neither. In the midst of a global pandemic rife with anxiety, loss, and uncertainty, Chancellor Agarwal, through the UMKC Forward initiative, is pursuing a vague, radical cost-cutting and restructuring plan which will constrain the future development of UMKC, reduce the university's contributions to Kansas City, and damage the value of a UMKC degree. It criticized the chancellor for planning a huge 15% budget cut when that much isn't needed. They then presented a list of demands in eight areas, which include allowing faculty to choose whether to teach in person or online, use research funds for child or elder care so that parents and caregivers who are employees and or limiting teaching loads, commit to a date when the salary reductions will end. The AAUP is very fearful that the UMKC Forward will turn the university into a soulless tech school, and they are demanding the maintenance of a commitment to a liberal arts education, which trains people in critical thinking and leads to a more informed and engaged citizenry. And a great degree of social progress, both STEM and liberal arts are essential. The AAUP also is demanding investment in graduate education and research and to maintain university co-governance instead of imposing top-down change. Finally, they demand cuts from the top, including top administrators and managers who have grown significantly in numbers in the last decade and balance support of the athletics with the academic mission of the university.
Yesterday, Jeff Bezos, owner of Amazon, was one of four tech CEOs called before Congress, on Zoom, of course, to answer questions about their anti-competitive practices. The other three were CEOs of Apple, Facebook, and Google's parent, Alphabet. Amazon has driven countless firms out of business, while Bezos was diversifying with purchases of The Washington Post and Whole Foods. Bezos certainly wasn't popular with Democrats on the committee, and Trump hates him too because he's a media mogul now. The pandemic has shown that Bezos isn't liked either by his workers, at least the ones at Amazon warehouses and Whole Foods. Indeed, there's an organization that's formed since the pandemic of Whole Foods workers called the Whole Worker. A visit to their webpage shows they are energetically organizing across the country and have made demands on Bezos for PPE, and they have won hazard pay. They also have been vigorously protesting the ban on Black Lives Matter masks and other clothing. As the pandemic continues, there will probably be more protests.
This comes from BuzzFeed. The Trump administration on Monday said it will not expel a group of immigrants, including an unaccompanied child detained by a Texas hotel under a policy that has immediately sent back thousands to the border. Last week, the Associated Press reported that Immigration and Customs Enforcement was holding unaccompanied minors, some as young as 1 year old, in hotels before quickly removing them without allowing them to go through U.S. legal immigration systems. A private contractor for ICE would take children to three Hampton Inn and Suite hotels in Arizona and at the Texas-Mexico border before sending them to their home countries. As a result of the lawsuit filed by the ACLU on behalf of Texas Civil Rights Project, 17 immigrants, including adults and children, detained at a Hampton Inn in McAllen, Texas, would instead be sent to U.S. refugee agencies. The hotel was the center of a protest over the practice last week, and where a Texas Civil Rights Project attorney trying to reach the children was pushed into an elevator wall by men in plain clothes. Immigrant children and families would wave at advocates from the hotel's windows or hold up signs saying they didn't have telephone access. The government hereby represents that the unnamed single minors who were at the identified hotel would be processed, attorneys for the government said, before court documents filed Monday. The adults and children covered by the lawsuit only represent a portion of all immigrants being quickly expelled from the U.S. The news from our side was read by Jen Zaman, Cortland Smith, Tom Gepkin, and myself, Michael Savoie.
On the road again, just can't wait to get on the road again. The life I love is making music with my friends, and I can't wait to get on the road again. On the road again, going places that I've never been, seeing things that I may never see again. I can't wait to get on the road.
Good evening, and welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm your host, Michael Savoie. You just heard Willie Nelson with On the Road Again. Our show tonight is titled Labor's Sacred Places. Joining us tonight is Saul Sinderman, a retired union activist who has served in some of our nation's most prestigious libraries, including the Department of Interior, the Library of Congress, the Smithsonian, and the GPO, the Government Publishing Office. Saul is past president of the Library of Congress Professional Guild and currently sits on the board of directors of Mother Jones Heritage Project. Good evening, Saul. Thank you for being on the Heartland Labor Forum.
Good evening, Michael. It's a pleasure to speak with you.
Indeed, it is. Yeah, Saul, if any of our listeners are on the road again, why, we certainly have got some interesting places to tell them about. But before we get to that, let me ask how you became interested in labor's historic landmarks.
Oh, I'm so glad you used the word labor landmarks. I got interested in this topic really back in the 70s through a woman who I'm sure your listeners know about as a great labor folk hero, and that would be Mary Harris Mother Jones. A lot of people know about Mother Jones. She was born in Cork, Ireland. She came to the United States, went to Memphis and married a union iron molder named George Jones and lost him, her husband, and all four of her children in a yellow fever epidemic in 1867 in Memphis. Distraught, she had nothing. She moved to Chicago, and eventually her dressmaking business burnt down in the Chicago fire. So she wandered the streets, homeless, and ended up in a church and a meeting of the Knights of Labor. And then the rest is history. Of course, she was hired as an organizer at the age of 60 by the United Mine Workers. And she has a very compelling story. And I was interested in her through a song called The Death of Mother Jones, which Gene Autry recorded in 1930, following her death. In fact, I'll sing the first verse of it for you. The world today is mourning the death of Mother Jones. Grief and sorrow hover over the miners' homes. This grand old champion of labor has gone to a better land. But the hard-working miners, they miss her guiding hand. Well, I was doing research on that song, and it took me to a book by Archie Green called Only a Miner. Archie is a labor folklorist, and in that book, I saw a broadside that said that Mother Jones had died on November 30th, 1930, in Silver Spring, Maryland. Well, that's my hometown, Michael. That's where I went to high school. So I decided to try to find the house that Mother Jones died in. And it's a bit of a long story, but to make it rather short, when Mother Jones came to Washington, you know, she traveled all over the United States. She had really no home. She stayed with Terence Powderly, the founder of the Knights of Labor here in Washington. And friends of the Powderlys were a woman and their husband named Lillian Burgess and Walter Burgess, who owned a farm out here in what is now Adelphi and used to be called Silver Spring. And Mother Jones would come out and stay with the Burgesses. And in fact, from 1928 to 1930, she lived with, was cared for by Lillian Burgess, and died there. And I, through my research, trying to find the house she died in, actually found a relative of the Burgesses, and who told me that he parked cars at Mother Jones's 100th birthday there. And eventually, by applying for an historic marker, which I did some years later, we were able to put up an historic marker at the site of her death. And I have to tell you, I'm sad to report to your listeners that when I did this research in the early 70s, I revisited it in the year 2000 and found that out of 400 historic markers in the state of Maryland, not one of them was about labor history, about union matters, or about the workers and the working class heritage that we have in the state. And this was the first one, a labor landmark that was established here in the state of Maryland. And that's what got me onto the road of the inventory of American labor landmarks.
Oh, absolutely, Saul, and I'm glad you did, man. You know, Mother Jones is perhaps one of the biggest figures in the American labor movement, and certainly we could use 1,000 just like her today. So when you say labor landmarks, Saul, tell our listeners, how do you distinguish a labor landmark?
Well, what happened is I eventually called Archie Green, who lived in San Francisco, and we, over the years, we talked and said, how many of these landmarks are in the United States? And we started collecting. And what we're talking about here are monuments and memorials. By the way, you know how many memorials there are to coal miners in the United States, especially around Worker Memorial Day, about accidents on the job and disasters, occupational illnesses, monuments, memorials, historic markers. Some people call them roadside signs, old union halls. If a union hall has historical significance, we started listing that. Public sculpture, commonly known as statues that are in a park. And by the way, I'm working with a group of people who are trying to get a statue to for Mother Jones in Chicago. Museums, labor history museums, labor history tours. I think you had a labor history tour in Kansas City. And in the beginning, we included labor murals. And we gave our collection a name, the Inventory of American Labor Landmarks. And we thought if we could list these, right, and many of them are online at laborheritage.org, sponsored by the Labor Heritage Foundation, people would go and visit them and to get an understanding of labor history through place. I said place, P-L-A-C-E, not space, not internet space, not computer space, but the actual physical place where events happened. And when you go to these, visit these sites, you can actually, with your mind's eye, experience labor history and labor heritage. We did not collect industrial sites. A lot of folks that are probably listening to your show are thinking of maybe factories or mines and mills and old factories that dot the landscape. I think you would call that industrial heritage or industrial history. We were talking about labor heritage and labor history.
Indeed. So, you know, I've been to a few of those monuments across our nation, and, man, I tell you, they're sacred places. If you have any inkling of what labor has gone through to to be in its rightful place in the in American hierarchy. And so certainly I'm glad that you've worked to put labor on that map. So tell us, Saul, how would we go about looking at some of these places? I kind of like the line out of your website that said, just dig where you stand.
Oh, well, there's two things you need to do before you dig where you stand. You have to stop and look and listen. And I think that especially with the pandemic, people are slowing down a bit. And the dig where you stand came from actually a Swedish author. The idea is that there's a rich labor history and heritage in your city, in your town, in your state. Believe me, Maryland, in many respects, is a southern state. And as I said, at the time I did the research on Mother Jones, there was one historic marker. And now, years later, there's still only three out of approximately 400 or 500. So, yes, dig where you stand. There's some wonderful labor history societies around the United States. Michigan has a labor history society, Pennsylvania, the Pacific Northwest, Wisconsin Labor History Society. And many of these have sites, where they call labor history sites, where you can go visit them. But the idea of digging where you stand is kind of makes it fun, because there's a discovery aspect. As I mentioned to you, I had no idea of course, the house that Mother Jones died in is no longer standing, and it's just simply a middle-class neighborhood here in Adelphi, Maryland. But the wonderful, beautiful marker that's there that calls her Mother Jones the Grand Old Champion of Labor has attracted trade union activists from the Washington area who come to the historic marker. We've had a couple of May Day celebrations there. The nearby church has opened its doors to us, and we've had some lectures on Mother Jones and community discussions. So, yeah, there is a history, a working-class history, a labor history, but it's buried beneath the surface. And so to get at it, dig where you stand.
You know, Saul, I took a look at some of the monuments there, and on Mother Jones's website, rather, and of course, just 289 miles from my door is Mother Jones's monument, the labor cemetery in which she was buried. So that's right in my backyard, you know. Why don't you tell our listeners, Saul, some of the historic labor monuments across our country, and we could talk about them briefly.
Well, you mentioned the Mother Jones Monument, which is in Mount Olive, Illinois, and that's just absolutely beautiful. I've been there. And talk about holy ground. She's buried in the Union Miners Cemetery in Mount Olive. Then the story behind that is that there was a strike in Mount Olive, in Zierden, Illinois, rather, and the strikers were not allowed, the ones who were died in that epic struggle, were not allowed to be buried in a public cemetery. So some progressive miners purchased a piece of land and called it Union Miner Cemetery, and Mother Jones said she wanted to be buried there. And there's a beautiful monument. It's a 22-foot-tall granite monument. She's flanked by two coal miners. And believe it or not, when it was erected in 1936, 50,000 people attended that dedication. So it's a small town, Mount Olive, but it's really, really worth going. Here's one, the Eugene V. Debs House in Terre Haute, Indiana. Eugene V. Debs, a founding member of the IWW and the American Railway Union, and probably the best-known socialist in the United States. He ran for president 5 times under the Socialist Party. And people may know that in 1918 he gave an anti-war speech in Canton, Ohio, and he was arrested for it and convicted, even though the war was over. And while he was in prison, he garnered a million votes. He ran for president in prison in his home in Terre Haute. has been preserved by a wonderful organization, Michael, called the Debs Foundation. It's a free museum, and you can go there, and for a $5 donation, you can take a tour of the home that Gene Debs lived in. That's pretty cool.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I actually put it on my list there, Saul, of places to visit. Go ahead.
Well, two other places you know that are really sacred. One, of course, is the Haymarket Martyrs Monument in Chicago. This is a labor landmark that is known throughout the world. In fact, foreign visitors from all over the world who come to Chicago want to visit the site where the Haymarket Martyrs were hung in the infamous Haymarket affair, fighting for the 8-hour day in 1886. There's a beautiful monument there in what used to be called Waldheim Cemetery. Now it's Forest Home Cemetery, and it's there's an inscription on the monument by one of the martyrs who was hung. It says, "The day will come when our silence will be more powerful than the voices you are throttling today." And in that same cemetery are a number of labor activists and radicals. Elizabeth Gurley Flynn is buried in near the Haymarket Martyrs Monument. Lucy Parsons and Emma Goldman are buried there. And there's always an event taking place on May 1st in Chicago at that famous labor monument. And then really the one that I have been to and love the most, even though it's such a sad tragedy, some say the most violent episode in American labor history, mm-hmm. is, of course, the one in Ludlow, Colorado, the mm-hmm. Ludlow Massacre Monument. The bitter class war between the Rockefeller mining interests and the United Mine Workers trying to establish themselves in the coal fields resulted in a pitched battle, including the murdering of two women and 11 children who were died when the state militia lit the tent colony in Ludlow on fire. And following that, the United Mine Workers erected, again, this is a National Historic Landmark, a beautiful monument to the miners who died there. And it's really well worth a visit. Well worth a visit.
Indeed. I've not been to that one, but I've certainly been to Chicago and certainly have experienced the Haymarket. Now tell me, Saul, are there any landmarks or dedications to people of color in the movement? Certainly we've had history there.
Well, you know, the National Park Service, which is really the guardians of American history in many ways because they manage the National Historic Landmark Program and the National Register of Historic Places, have even admitted that people who are not represented, African Americans, Latino Americans, women, and by the way, they include in that labor and workers, these populations have been marginalized often in our society, and so in order to identify these sites, they have conducted various theme studies, right, trying to urge people to preserve the history of women, of African Americans. And so, yes, there's been a movement in the last 15, and I'm sure this will continue, especially considering the killing of George Floyd. Yes, there's a number of places for people of color. There are two beautiful statues, speaking of a labor leader, A. Philip Randolph. One is in Union Station here in Washington, D.C. Of course, he helped to organize the Pullman porters into the first black union and the first union to sign a contract with the Pullman Company. There's a beautiful bust of him here at Union Station in D.C. And also in Boston, again, appropriately at a railroad. Station, there's a wonderful statue of him that was put up by the A. Philip Randolph Society, which some of your union audiences might know as a group of African-American trade unionists who are devoted to his memory. In regards to women, there is a wonderful preserved home to Kate Mullaney, who was an Irish immigrant living in Troy, New York, who organized a strike there during the 1850s. These were laundry workers. Troy, New York, was a place where collars, people used to have detachable collars, and they were always needed to be starched and cleaned, and there was a big industry there in upstate New York. She organized a group of Irish immigrant women, and I must say it was Hillary Clinton, when she was a senator of New York, who saw that this house be preserved. It's called the Kate Mullaney House, and it's in Troy, New York. That's another place. And then, of course, and I hope to go out and visit this one day, Barack Obama honored Cesar Chavez, the great labor leader and folk hero to Latino people in California and throughout the United States, founder of the United Farm Workers with Dolores Huerta. His gravesite is now in what's referred to as a national monument in Keene, California, which is really where Union headquarters was. And you can go there and visit his gravesite and go to a small museum and gift shop there. So, yes, there is a movement afoot to preserve marginalized populations. And by the way, I would include the labor movement in that.
Indeed.
Because we're so marginalized in this country.
Absolutely. Listen, Saul, we're down to our last minute. But before we get off the air, I took a look at the Mother Jones Heritage Project, of which I believe you're a part of. And I was able to make a small contribution to what I understand is a serious effort being made to construct a statue to Mother Jones. Could you tell our listeners a little about that before we sign off, and maybe even give the website?
Oh, I'd be happy to. Well, Mother Jones, as they say, said that her dress was like her shoes. She carried it with her. But if there was a place, even though she died here in Maryland, but if there was a place she called home, it was Chicago. And so there is a movement by the Mother Jones Heritage Project, of which I'm a board member, and we are trying to raise $200,000 to have a major monument, a major statue of Mother Jones, erected down by the Chicago River in downtown Chicago. Mm-hmm. And we have some funding from the Irish government, and we have two wonderful artists, sculptors, we're lined up, and we're just needing to raise funds. And for your listeners who wish to contribute, it's very easy to remember the website. It's motherjonesmuseum.org.
Okie doke. So we're going to have to cut it off there, buddy. But I tell you what, I think it's certainly a great opportunity to discuss these things, as labor has been fairly well overlooked in the annals of our history. But then we didn't write the history books, did we? So thank you for being on the Heartland Labor Forum tonight, Saul. And wish the best to you, and looking forward maybe to seeing you at one of America's sacred labor places.
Solidarity forever.
Right on, brother.
Do you have an old car, truck, motorcycle, or boat that you're ready to toss? Find out how your toss can be KKFI's gain. Call Bill at 816-931-3122. That's 816-931-3122. And ask for Bill.
August 4th is primary election day in Kansas and Missouri. Missouri voters will decide on Medicaid expansion. Key races in the KC metro area include the governor and other executive positions in Missouri, and who will represent Kansas in the U.S. Senate and Kansas District 3. This message is a public service of 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
And that was This Land Is Your Land, sung by Bob Dylan. Well, at least the intro. So, I am Christina Disman. You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight, we're going to be talking with local immigration attorney Claire Murphy-Shaw about the Trump's administration changes to asylum law and what impact that might have on migrants that are seeking refuge and safety here in the United States. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Well, first of all, thank you so much for being on air. I know that our short show right now doesn't have enough time to cover how much has been changing with the recent proposal by the Trump administration on asylum, but hopefully our listeners tonight can get a little bit more information on what's happening.
Sure. I'll do my best to give a brief recap and hopefully not make it too technical.
Oh, that's perfectly fine. But first of all, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you got involved in immigration law?
Sure. I came to Kansas City about 22 years ago now to work at Legal Aid of Western Missouri on Southwest Boulevard at their Migrant Farm Workers Assistance Fund as a social worker and a paralegal. And I spent 4 years there doing outreach and working under an immigration attorney there at Legal Aid and learning all about all the different struggles that the migrant population faced. And it just really inspired me to continue on and go to law school at University of Missouri and focus on immigration law. I learned Spanish as an undergraduate, and I just felt like my skill set would be well used in this area of law.
And which is definitely needed. I mean, especially here in Kansas City, some people don't think it's a hub for immigration, but Kansas City, here we do have one of the few immigration courts located central to the United States. But for our listeners who may not know the difference, could you tell us the difference between what an asylum seeker is and what a refugee is?
Sure. A refugee basically is a person who's been granted permission to come to the United States and given refugee status from the outside of the United States. So they often are living in refugee camps, for example, in Tanzania or Kenya, and they would be waiting potentially for years and years to get approved to come to the United States, and they would be entering the United States on a visa. The difference with an asylum seeker is they oftentimes are fleeing their home country based on persecution and many times fleeing for their lives. And so they don't have an opportunity to seek asylum. You can't apply for asylum from your home country. You have to come to the United States, and many times they'll present at a port of entry along the border, or they will enter irregularly, we would say, like crossing the border and presenting themselves either to the CBP or getting apprehended by CBP, Customs and Border Patrol, and then seeking asylum from within the United States.
Thank you for describing that to us, because I know that sometimes it's some people may not necessarily know the difference, but right now some of the biggest changes that are happening is to laws and rules surrounding asylum. Back in June, the Trump administration announced that they will be proposing significant changes to these laws and rules with asylum here in the United States. And I know since last July, I mean, things have been developing over the year, but we have some of the biggest proposed changes recently. What are some of the top changes that the administration is trying to make, and how are these going to affect those people fleeing persecution and violence?
Yeah, so the Trump administration has put a bullseye, basically, on asylum seekers and has made it one of its top priorities to eviscerate the asylum system as it exists in the United States. And this new set of proposed regulations is kind of the nail in the coffin. And it's kind of going to just basically make it almost impossible to seek asylum here. But what you have to do to qualify to seek asylum is you have to be fleeing your home country. You have to have a fear of persecution based on a protected ground. And those protected grounds include race, religion, nationality, membership in a particular social group, or your political opinion. And then you can't be barred for some other reason. For example, a criminal history, having participated in persecution of another person, things like that. And then you have to apply within 1 year of entering the United States. So this new regulation does a lot of things. It heightens the standards that are applied to these grounds. It allows judges to basically summarily just deny applications so even before the applicant has had a hearing. So it's an attack on due process. It redefines some of the core grounds for asylum claims, including what membership in a particular social group is. And that will have a dire impact, especially on women and LGBTQ individuals who are claiming asylum based on their membership in those types of groups. It would essentially end asylum for those fleeing from violence, from intimate partners and family members and gangs, and others who don't fit the definition of a state actor, because essentially the persecutor needs to be either the government or a person that the government is unwilling or unable to control. It changes the definition of persecution. It raises the legal standard for passing a credible fear interview. So a credible fear interview is what a person would undergo at the border when they're trying to seek entry into the United States, and they've claimed that they have a fear of return. And so they'll actually get an interview to determine whether they should be allowed to pursue their claim or not. And so it raises the standard so that it makes it that much harder to meet that initial threshold of even being able to come in and seek due process. And then it allows for asylum denials on other discretionary factors, such as entering the United States between a port of entry or transiting through a third country, which is a huge majority of the people who come seeking asylum. And it basically deprives people of their day in court. And it's really a violation of, I think, our standards as Americans, you know, our values. I think it betrays those values. So that's my quick and dirty overview. It's a very complicated and long regulation, and I could go on and on about all the ways that it diminishes people's rights, but that gives you just kind of the big broad overview.
Exactly. It was hard to break it down because there's the document is... I was opening up the document of the proposed changes, and it was well over about 100 pages, maybe a little right. a little bit less. So it was language that you had to go through. There's just nuanced changes, even whenever I was going through reading it myself. I mean, our short interview doesn't go over everything, but I still appreciate you kind of tackling some of the bigger issues that's happening. And one that I'm personally curious about is, How might these changes impact asylum seekers who are trying to obtain work permits here in the United States?
Yeah, that's another area that has really come under scrutiny under the Trump administration, is work authorization for folks who are here while their asylum case is pending. And a lot of these people who are seeking asylum face really prolonged processes. They are sometimes waiting for years to have their day in court. And so while they're waiting, traditionally under the current rules have been eligible to apply for a work authorization document, or an EAD is what we call it. And in the past, those documents needed to be produced quickly for asylum seekers, because we recognize that these people don't have anything. A lot of times they're coming here with literally the clothes on their back. And so they need to be able to work to support themselves. And so under the new regulations altering the eligibility for work cards that's also been released, it removes a 30-day processing time for initial work permit applications for pending asylum seekers. So that just opens up USCIS to basically take as long as they want to produce, to give the approval and produce the work card. And that is really going to harm people who are desperate to get started providing for themselves and for their families. Another change that is going to be implemented starting August 25th is that instead of being eligible to apply after just 150 days, which is long enough, they're going to have to wait 365 days before they can even apply to get that work permit.
That's just outrageous. Like 150 days, that's 6 months.
Right. And now we were extending it to an entire year. So how do people who are here with sometimes children, oftentimes they'll have more children while they're waiting, for example. I mean, they've got families. They've got to feed themselves. They have to put a roof over their head. And to me, these changes just exemplify the cruelty of this administration just wanting to really make life impossible for asylum seekers and put them up against a wall. And it's awful because they have no other place to go. Most of them are already fleeing incredible violence in their home countries and threats of death. I mean, they're not here on a vacation. They're here because they have very few choices about how to keep themselves and their families safe. And so to me, it's just incredibly cruel to make them go through all these hoops and wait this long to be given an opportunity to legally work here in the United States. So, it's devastating for a lot of my clients. That's just a couple of the issues with EADs. They're also going to be denied for what they're calling applicant cause delays. They've added more bars. So if a person crosses the border into the United States irregularly, so they don't present at a port of entry, then they're not going to be eligible. They'll be barred from receiving any work authorization at all unless they meet a few narrow exceptions. And it also limits the amount of time that they can get a work authorization to 2 years, so it caps their work authorization. So a lot of times, like I said, these processes take a long time to play out, and that doesn't come in. There's no discretion. It's a two-year period max. And that's going to leave a lot of people without work authorization, even though their case is still pending. And then if they miss that one-year filing deadline that I mentioned, they are also going to be ineligible for work authorization.
That just seems so outrageous because I don't know, I can't think of a person who has not missed some sort of deadline at some point in time or forgot to file something. Here in the United States, just as citizens, we forget. There's times like when we have deadlines to meet something, we've missed a deadline because we're human. We forget and how strict these regulations are on asylum seekers coming in. It just seems outrageous.
Yeah, I think the real problem at the crux is that a lot of people in removal proceedings don't have legal representation. It's just out of reach for a lot of reasons. It's expensive, and it's not guaranteed by our immigration courts that people have representation like you would in a criminal court, because this is actually administrative law. It's a different type of court than what we think of when we think of criminal courts. And so there's no right to an appointed counsel for people who are defending themselves against deportation. So they basically have to hope that they can find someone to take their case at a reasonable price. And a lot of times it's impossible for them to find and hire an attorney in time in order to meet the one-year filing deadline. Or they just can't accomplish it for whatever reason, financial or otherwise. So it's really harsh. These rules are just really, really harsh. And I guess it shouldn't be a surprise, because we've seen all kinds of harsh rule changes in all areas of immigration law since the beginning of this administration. And to be honest, prior, immigrants have been demonized. And, we've seen all kinds of political changes that have affected the way that immigrants are able to apply for benefits in the United States, or with the way they've been treated at the border. Under the Obama administration, there was a lot of cruelty as well, including family detention. And so it's not a new problem, but I think that what we've seen over the past 3 years has been really unprecedented in terms of the level of attack and the level of cruelty that this administration's willing to inflict on families, especially on asylum seekers and even on children at the border.
And you actually bring up a good point. First of all, I've heard before that people that I've talked to that have gone through the immigration process, at one point in time, you could have represented yourself and you may have gone through just fine. But I feel like representing yourself now and having a successful case is nearly impossible.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's gotten so complicated and the stakes are so high. it used to be, I would say, that there was a fair number of people who could figure out how to file something with USCIS, for example, to apply for a green card, or even to apply to naturalize, which means to become a U.S. citizen. Now, if you apply and you're not eligible for whatever it is you're applying for, if you make a mistake, you could end up putting yourself into removal proceedings just by applying for something at USCIS. So the stakes are very, very high in all of these proceedings, whether you're at USCIS, which typically used to be considered the benefits agency, or if you're applying in court for something. It's become so complicated, so difficult, and so risky that it's really not recommended to try to attempt it without an attorney.
Yeah, something you shouldn't go by yourself. And you were mentioning children down at the border as well. I hear there are some recent developments about unaccompanied minors crossing the southern border. Do you know about those recent developments?
Sure. In the past, unaccompanied minors, which is a person under the age of 18 who comes to the border without a parent or a legal guardian available to care for them, they've been granted certain protections under the law because they are such a vulnerable population. We recognize that they're so at risk of human trafficking or of abuse, and so the government has identified them as a group that should be protected. And so we set up a whole system of shelters to actually take the jurisdiction of these kids out from under ICE and put it with the Office of Refugee Resettlement, so that the kids could be put somewhere safe, protected, given access to attorneys, given access to due process, and given access to clinicians and case managers who would help them reunify with a sponsor. Now, under Title 42, which is a health code, at the U.S. border, instead of processing kids in, anyone in, but including children, they're just being returned to Mexico or to their home countries. If it's other than Mexico, they will be, what we've heard from advocates and anecdotally is that they're actually taking children at the southern border and holding them in hotel rooms using a subcontractor of ICE and then removing the children without basically holding them incommunicado and never processing them into that system that I explained to you, the Office of Refugee Resettlement. So it's a blatant violation of the laws that have been put in place to protect kids. And it's very, very frightening. I know that there's a lot of efforts to stop it. So the Texas Civil Rights Project and the American Civil Liberties Union have both sued DHS in federal court, basically saying, quote, they're stashing children in the hotels at the border away from advocates and lawyers in order to hurriedly expel them without hearings or any of the mandatory protections that unaccompanied children get under the law. So I'm hoping that that's going to be, this practice is going to stop. But the pandemic is giving the Trump administration license, basically, to carry out the most cruel and inhumane procedures and policies that they've been honestly wanting to do all along. They've been wanting to stop any asylum seekers from crossing the border. They've been wanting to stop offering protections to unaccompanied minors. And now, with the pandemic, they've got basically a justification to do so.
And I feel like there's a lot of law changes, law concerns that are happening that could go on and on to talk about. And what you're bringing up, I feel like it's a really big concern, a lot what's happening at this moment when it comes to immigration, when it comes to asylum seekers. And as we're getting to our last minute of our show, if our audience is wanting to learn more about these proposed changes or what's happening, where can they go to find more information?
I would recommend checking out the Catholic Legal Immigration Network's website. It's got a lot of great information posted about the lawsuits that are happening all across the country to try to stop some of these practices. The Innovation Law Lab also keeps a lot of great information posted and shares all the recent updates of the law. Immigrant Advocates Network is another excellent organization, along with the American Immigration Lawyers Association. And then locally,
The Asylum Clinic KC is the website and organization that I run, and I try to keep folks apprised of developments that affect especially children. And we have a Twitter and Facebook page, so people should follow Asylum Clinic, Asylum Clinic KC.
All right. Thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Sure, it was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Oh, thank you. And guys, that was Claire Murphy Shaw. Talk to us about Trump's changes in asylum laws. I'm Christine Disming, and you're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
And this is the HLF calendar for this week. And all of these events that I'm going to be listing can be found on the HLF Facebook page. This weekend, phone bank for Medicaid expansion on the August 2nd ballot, and that you can do that activism from your home. Call Jameson at 816-809-9441. And then Sunday, August 2nd, from 12:30 to 2 p.m., is Brookside Black Lives Matter Brigade, We Must All Come Together, which is going to be at the corner of 63rd and Brookside. It's hosted by the Unity Southeast, by Unity Southeast in Kansas City, the Miller Dream LLC, and two others. Tuesday, August 4th, from 10 a.m. to 1, is an emergency food drive, and it's put on by Harvesters, Avila University, and the Catholic Charities of Kansas City and St. Joseph. To participate, contact L. Hopkins at ccharities.com for location or to volunteer. And lastly, August 8th, from 10 a.m. to 2, is the first annual Social Justice Boot Camp, Building Collective Power. You can find this at actionnetwork.org, and it's hosted by the Real Justice Network. And once again, you can check out the Heartland Labor Forum schedule on our Facebook page. Next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, we'll be looking at teachers who are looking at school reopenings. I've been your engineer and your host, Jen Zaman. And Judy will be back next week.
Listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, a show by and about workers, our workplaces, and our labor movement. We are radio that talks back to the boss, and you can talk back too. Send us your workplace stories, news, and ideas for shows to heartlandlaborforumkkfi@gmail.com. Our website, where we archive shows and post our upcoming schedule, is heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here at 90.1 FM KKFI.
The common man's rights to be in the working class is good enough for me.
No one can deny.